This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
When you have health insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. But are your bills accurate? It's estimated over 50% of medical bills contain errors. HealthLock can help. HealthLock technology securely connects with your insurance and flags any overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. To date, HealthLock has helped its members save over $130 million. To save, visit HealthLock.com today.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Taking a walk.
I'm desperately trying to finish these songs before the first show. Just on a whim, I was in my car and I'm like, you know, let me listen to a songwriting podcast and see what someone who I don't know has to say about songwriting. The guy was saying that if you write a song in 20 minutes, chances are it's not very good and no one's ever going to hear it. And yeah, I wrote Set Me Free in 20 minutes. It just came out of the clear blue.
Welcome to the Taking a Walk podcast, an audio diary of insightful conversations with music insiders. On this episode, Buzz Knight talks with Kasim Sultan, bass guitarist, writer, keyboardist, and vocalist best known for his work with Todd Rundgren and Utopia. Kasim continues to have a distinguished career over four decades, and chances are music he's been involved in is part of a daily playlist in your life. To date, Sultan has played and sung on albums that have sold more than 85 million copies. He's toured with Hall & Oates, Cheap Trick, and Joan Jett, along with the late Meatloaf. Let's join Buzz Knight next with Kasim Sultan.
Well, let's enter our virtual Taking a Walk studio, and special guests, please enter and sign in, please.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kasim Sultan. Multi-instrumentalist, singer-songwriter, dad, grandfather, widow, carpenter sometimes, lawnmower, dishwasher, chief cook and bottle washer.
I love it. It's so nice to see you again, albeit virtually.
You too, bud. It's good to see you.
Now, when you're in a recording process, writing process, do you ever get stuck and literally break yourself free by going for a walk?
I go for a drive. I used to do that quite often. Now I take my dog for a walk. Sometimes that helps. Most of the time, it's more about just being diligent and trying to force through a writer's block, you know, which I'm not and never have been a very prolific songwriter. I pain over my work. A lot of times people say, you know, you're sacrificing product for perfection. But, you know, everyone is different.
But somebody told me you wrote the hit song Set Me Free in 20 minutes. Is that true?
Yeah, you know, it's really funny too, because I was going somewhere. I had to go to an event in the Bronx last night. I live on Staten Island, and I had to go to the Bronx, and I was looking for and we could talk about this in a minute, but I'm about to go on tour with The Fix. I'm opening for them on their North American tour coming up in November, and I have a couple of new songs that I want to debut during my opening set, because it's just me, solo acoustic. And so I'm desperately trying to finish these songs before the first show. And I was in my car and I'm like, you know, let me listen to a songwriting podcast and see what someone who I don't know has to say about songwriting. And this guy was saying, I'm not going to mention the podcast, but the guy was saying that, if you write a song in 20 minutes, chances are it's not very good and no one's ever going to hear it. And I wrote Set Me Free in 20 minutes. All but the bridge. It just came out of the clear blue, and it was at a particularly difficult time in my career. I was signed to Bearsville Records as a recording as a solo recording artist. I desperately wanted to do a solo album, and Albert Grossman didn't feel that my material was ready yet, that I still had some growing to do as a songwriter, and he didn't want to let me have a solo album. Or record a solo album. And my attitude was, look, then fine, then let me go somewhere else. Let me find another record label that's willing to put a record out for me. And he said, okay, that's fine. You owe me X amount of dollars and 10% of any future royalties you have on your first record. And I just thought that was just, you know, a horrible, horrible thing. It's business, you know, that's the business that we have chosen. And that's why I wrote Set Me Free, to get out of a record contract.
What was that like dealing with Albert Grossman? And did you sort of get intertwined by the nature of that relationship somehow inside the Bob Dylan and band camp at all?
Albert was a fascinating guy. It was really, really a really very interesting man. I mean, the history of between him and Bob Dylan and Janis Joplin and the band and Jesse Winchester and countless other acts. And the fact that he had been around since the very early 60s, you were kind of in awe being in his presence, because he was certainly a force to be reckoned with. But he never really, my dealings with Albert were strictly, on a solo basis and through Utopia. And, Albert never really, he never liked the fact that Todd had a band that took him away from his work with his solo work. Albert was always begrudgingly accepting of Utopia, because it was Todd's, you know, that was Todd's little side project. And again, Albert would have been fine if Todd never had a band in terms of something or a project that took him away from his solo albums. But Todd always had, it was always separate. It was always, Utopia was Utopia and Todd's solo was Todd's solo. So,
yeah, I think I saw that Roger Powell from Utopia, he said that Bearsville wished that Utopia had never existed. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what I just said. You know, Albert did not think that Utopia was anything that had any legs. He just thought that it was a distraction from Todd's solo material, which was a lot more successful than Utopia.
Was that a motivation for you guys?
No, I don't think it was a motivation. I don't think we thought of it either way. If anything, it was disappointing. You know, we were always disappointed that Bearsville didn't take Utopia more seriously. But you know, we soldiered on and did our tours and did our records and I have a letter up in my music room that from Albert to the band about one of the records that we did, and his saying that he doesn't think it's going to be a very a commercial success, so therefore Bearsville doesn't want to put it out. He doesn't like the way it sounds. He doesn't like the songs, and he basically turned the record down.
So when did you first meet Todd Rundgren?
So I got wind of the that Utopia was looking for a bass player, John Siegler, who was the bass player. The band had gone from a seven-piece band with three keyboard players and Todd and background singers and Moogie Klingman and John Siegler and Roger Powell and Jean-Yves Labatt, Willie Wilcox, Todd, and at one point Luther Vandross and David Lasley were the background singers.
Wow.
In Utopia. Yeah. And Todd was doing the record Faithful, and which was a solo record. And John Siegler decided that he was going to pursue a career in advertising music, creating music for commercials and television and movies. And so he left the band. He didn't want to tour anymore. A friend of mine, Michael Kamen, who I had known through Cherry Vanilla, was contacted by Roger Powell, and Roger asked Michael if he knew of any bass players. It's a very convoluted story. And Michael called Earl Slick up, who was a very good friend of mine, and I grew up with Earl, and said, if you know any bass players, Todd Rundgren's looking for one for his band Utopia. I just happened to see Slick, and he mentioned it to me, and he said, if you want to audition, call Michael Kamen up, which is what I did. And then the next day I was on an Adirondack Trailways bus up to Woodstock to rehearse with Roger Powell and Willie Wilcox, the keyboard player and the drummer, for Todd's return from India. He was mopeding through India at that time. He was due back the next day, and we were going to, I was going to audition for the band. So that was the first, that was April, 8, 9, 10, or 11 of 1976. So that's the first time I met Todd, to answer your question. That's a very long answer to your question.
So in your years with Todd, what traits did he teach you or rub off on you in terms of either his work process, the way he, you know, wrote songs or his disciplines? What did you learn from Todd?
I really cut my teeth in that band. You know, everything up to that point was kind of getting ready to be in a band like that, a national recording touring band. So while I had always dabbled in trying to record songs and trying to write songs and playing live, everything that I learned, the foundation of my entire career was was based around what I learned in those first five, six, 7 years in being in Utopia. Todd was didn't necessarily set out to sit me down and say, okay, son, well, here's how you record a lead vocal, and this is how you write a background part, and this is where I place the microphone to record a guitar amp. And no, it was nothing like that. It was just all about, you know, watching him work, watching how he worked with other people. And just taking that and making it my own. One of the most interesting thing was right after I joined the band, I was asked by Todd to play on a record that he was producing, that was Meatloaf, Bat Outta Hell. That was probably the second record that I'd ever recorded. It was fascinating watching him as a producer and an arranger for all those songs, like Bat Outta Hell and Paradise by the Dashboard Lights, Two Out of Three Ain't Bad, Took the Words Right Out of My Mouth, and how he worked as a producer and as an arranger and as kind of like a leader in the studio when it came to recording somebody else's music. So that was fascinating, and I learned so much about how, you know, how to make records and how to put a band together and stuff like that. So yeah, I learned a lot from Todd.
What's in the secret sauce to a album like that, that makes it just, you know, from start to finish, just so unbelievable?
I think that things like that, you don't really necessarily realize it at the time, that you're kind of making, you know, something that's going to be iconic and last for a very, very long time. The secret sauce, it's just chemistry, you know. It's a group of people that get put together, and the sum is greater than the parts. So you are you're a little piece of it, but everyone's contribution together makes this really, really special thing. And it's I don't think it's anything that you can really there's no cookie cutter, there's no mold for it. It just either happens or it doesn't, you know.
Do you recall where you were when you first heard a song from that album on the radio?
Yeah, I was in my car. I was driving. I had a little Alfa Romeo GTV, and I was driving up to Woodstock to start a tour. I was on the Palisades Parkway, and I was listening to WNEW, as a matter of fact, the song came on, and I said to myself, that sounds vaguely familiar. I know I've heard that song somewhere before, and I could not put my finger on it for the first, I don't know, 30 seconds or something like that. And then I said, oh, that's the record that I did with Todd. It was Bat Outta Hell, as a matter of fact. It was the song Bat Outta Hell. And I thought, wow, that's really cool. They got on NEW. That's great. That was a milestone in any musician's life, to have your record played on WNEW, especially in the afternoon drive.
The place where rock lives.
There you go. Yeah.
What a special feeling hearing it. My God.
Yeah, that was, it was very interesting. And then the album just exploded, and the rest is history.
So it sounds like Scott Muni was the one from NEW. It was the first one that played it, maybe.
Possibly. I think it might have played in Cleveland before that. I think Kid Leo might have grabbed a hold of it and started the ball rolling. I know there is an article out there about where it really took hold. But I think by the time that Scott played it or anybody at NEW played it, it was already something that people were calling up. And it's when people used to call up and say, I want you to play this record, you know, those days.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. I think there was a Cleveland connection, not only with Kid Leo, but for some reason, I think in the music distribution side of it, there was some Cleveland.
Well, it was Steve Popovich from who had Cleveland International, which was a subsidiary of Epic, Epic Records. And it was Steve who, they tried to get RCA to buy the record. They tried to get CBS to buy the record. They tried to get Warner Brothers to buy the record. Nobody wanted it. And this was after it was done. No one wanted it. And that's when Cleveland International and Steve Popovich heard it and heard something there and decided that they were going to get behind it. And again, it's like I said a few minutes ago, which is that whole thing about, you know, the stars just align and it becomes something that that all the pieces just fit together and the puzzle becomes whole.
Why is it that the song Very Last Time and then More Than a Feeling is one of the greatest segues of all time?
maybe because we consciously, I think we were a little tired at that point of making records that more people weren't listening to. We wanted to reach a larger audience, and Todd had this great idea. He said, why don't we do this? Why don't we listen to the Billboard top, take a look at what's the Billboard top 10 at that particular time in history. And I think it was like 78 or 79. Yeah, it might have been 78. And let's just try to cop that vibe of those songs. Like if there's, I've for the life of me, I can't remember what other songs were out at that time. There might have been some R&B song that was very popular. Boston was huge, and more than a Feeling was, I might have been a number one hit. I'm pretty sure it was. So we just tried to craft songs that were like that, you know, and I think we did a pretty good job, you know, and that's where most of that record came from, was taking a look at what was popular and what was getting the most traction on radio and in the charts at that particular moment in time, and then just copying them. You know, just trying to make them our own, rewrite them, if you will.
You spent some time with Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. Tell me how wonderful that experience was.
I love Joan. She was a fantastic to work with, and Ricky Bird, the guitar player in the Blackhearts, we're still very, very close to this day. As a matter of fact, I have a show with him on Saturday that I'm doing. That was about 3.5 years, I think. Tommy Price, who was another fellow Staten Islander, we grew up together, and Tommy was a very in-demand drummer in the early 80s. Everybody was using Tommy on their record. He got a call to play with Joan. Joan needed a bass player. Tommy recommended me because we were best friends. And I came in, and then I was in Joan's band for the next, I guess, 3.5 years, from 86 to 90.
And then how about your time working with the great Hall & Oates?
One of the best bands that I've ever been in. There were two gentlemen besides Daryl and John. There were two gentlemen in that band that are no longer with us, that I was and remain in awe of their musicality. And that was T-Bone Walk, who was the drummer. I'm sorry. T-Bone Walk, who was the bass player. He was the bass player for the longest time. When I was in the band, T-Bone took guitar duties, and so I played bass. But just a brilliant musician and a lovely, lovely guy. And Bobby Mayo, the keyboard player, who was one of the best keyboard players, piano, organ players that I've ever worked with in my entire life to this day. Just guys there's no bottom to the well of their knowledge of, you know, of music. And so that was one of the best bands that I was ever in. The 2 or 3 years that I played with Daryl and John were, that was a great, great, great time.
When I think of your well of music, and I think of diversity of styles and interests, you know, I think of the work that you did around the Broadway, the Twyla Tharp project, you know, in particular. So what things that you haven't done do you want to do?
You know, I was just toying with the idea of doing a big band. There's a guy who does, a guy by the name of Charlie Rosen, who does it's called the 8-Bit Big Band, and they do video game music with a big band, like Mario Brothers and some other stuff that's like just out, completely out there. Also, this other guy that does a big band. He does Zappa and Todd music with like a 30-piece orchestra. So I always wanted. I had this idea that I would do a bunch of songs that I've had over my career, not just solo, but with other artists, with a big band. So that's something that I would love to do. It's just so cost prohibitive, you know, to put together something like that and then do a show. It's a lot of money to put a band like that together. So yeah, that's something that I would love to do.
As you contemplate going on the road in the upcoming tour with The Fix, and you think of live performance, do you have three maybe concert performances you as a fan went to that stand out in memory, you know, whether it be the greatness of the artist or the venue or the whole package?
Yeah. So the first concert that I really, I distinctly remember was Led Zeppelin at Madison Square Garden in 1970. I want to say 72 or 73. It was right after Led Zeppelin III came out. And I went, I guess I was either 14 or 15 years old. And they were just amazing. They were so good. Another one was The Dolls at the Mercer Arts Center in Manhattan. It was a very small club. And seeing The Dolls, and I'm just like, I had no clue what that was about. But I remember it made an impression on me. And the other one was was either Jeff Beck at Carnegie Hall for the Orange album with Bob Tench and Cozy Powell, when they did that record, or Cactus on Staten Island. They used to be a venue on Staten Island called the Ritz, and everybody came through here. I saw the James Gang there. Cactus Mountain at Woolman Rink was just amazing. It's just a 3-piece band. It was just so big. And I just remember saying, you know, but boy, I can't wait to be doing that. I can't wait to be on a stage like that. That was my dream.
That's awesome. So you're looking forward to this tour coming up?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. I know the guys in the Fix pretty well, and they were kind enough to offer me the opening slot. It's about 15 or 16 shows that I'm doing over the course of November. You know, it's interesting as an opening act. You kind of have a little bit of a captive audience. Nobody's leaving while you play. I'm very excited about being able to play for some new people, and hope that that it goes well.
So, in closing, as such a student of it all, and someone with such great disciplines, if someone's listening to this and they are working their way up the music ladder as a musician, what advice do you have for them?
It's such a different time right now. There are so many more avenues to kind of, you know, get your stuff out there and to be heard and to create and make a record. You don't need to be in a recording studio anymore. You could do it in your bedroom like Billie Eilish and her brother and become hugely successful. Or you can build an audience by playing live, and then working social media. You know, Todd said one thing to me when I had just joined the band. I'll never forget. We were in Paris, and I might have been playing the Hippodrome in Paris, some large venue. We were having a chat on the side of the stage in the middle of the show. Actually, I forget what was going on that we had time to talk in the middle of the show. And he said, you know, he said, the real trick is knowing when to stop. It's like, if it's not happening for you, you know, knowing when it's time to do something else. He said, a lot of people just keep banging their head against the wall when it's kind of not going to happen. But having said that, if you have the strength and the fortitude and the conviction and the belief that what you are doing is really, really good, then just keep doing it.
Thank you for the joy of the music that you continue to give us, and good luck on the tour.
Thank you so much, Buzz. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk.
Thanks for listening to Taking a Walk. To stay up to date with the podcast, subscribe to our newsletter at takingawalk.substack.com. Find us on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.